Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the podcast. My name is Colin McEwen, and we are about to talk to a diplomat. Today, we're giving some love to a country that really doesn't get it all that very much. Slovakia is a NATO member, and is a member of the Eurozone, yet very seldom gets any attention in English-speaking media. I had the chance to talk to one of the foremost Slovak Canadians, Professor Stanislav Kirschbaum, of Glendon College at York University. So, without further ado, let's see what he had to say. I noticed in the extensive list of publications they have on your website, which deals, you know, extensively with Slovak history, what would you say, I guess, is the relevance of it for someone who was born and grew up after 89? Like, say, young Canadians or Slovaks today whom, at least in our research here, we've noticed that they're attention and level of caring about certain historical or international things is not really there.
Well, I suppose anyone, taken from a Canadian point of view and a point of view of a Canadian, let's say it was a new Canadian or descendant of new Canadians, knowledge of one's historical past, the border past of one's family, is always, you know, an interesting thing to know. Where you come from, who your ancestors were, why did your parents, or what did you leave if you left as a child, you know, your country of birth, what were the conditions? And in the case of Slovakia, of course, it's all the more interesting because Slovakia, in terms of a state, as you say, comes on the scene in 1993, was for all intents and purposes not well known before that. It was part of Czechoslovakia. Usually the term Czech was applied to the entire country, so often Slovaks were referred to as Czechs. And so, you know, the study of this country's history, which is something I've devoted most of my professional life to, was to, you know, bring up to date the history of a people whose political destinies were manifold from the moment they arrived in Central Europe in the 6th century and when they first created their own political state, which was the Empire of Great Moravia in the 9th century, basically, and then why it disappeared, what happened to the people who were then taken over politically by the Hungarians in the Kingdom of Hungary. How come they survived, their language, their culture, their way of life? And what happened, what explains the reason for their leaving Hungary, becoming part of Czechoslovakia? And then ultimately, why also Czechoslovakia fell apart, as it did on December 31st, 1992, to create the country today known as the Republic of Slovakia.
From what you've just summarized, it's seems pretty clear to any observer that the existence of the country, the nation, is, you know, always been highly contested. I guess how would you explain this to someone who's from a country that's not contested nearly as much?
Well, that's a very good question, and that applies to not just to Slovakia, the Slovaks, or Central Europe, but to many other parts of the world. And that's a really very broad question that involves not just historical knowledge, but also a certain amount of economic knowledge, sociological knowledge. Why do some people not get recognition and others do? Take the Kurds, for example. The Kurds have existed for a long, long time. They're spread out throughout the Middle East, though they are concentrated in a particular area of Iraq and also of Iran, if I'm not mistaken. And yet, you mentioned the Kurds. There's never been a Kurdish state. There may be one in the making now as a result of a potential breakup of Iraq. But what I'm suggesting is that how does one explain that to a Canadian where really it is a country that was formed from various elements that has been keeping itself together through a political maneuvering of various elements to do so? Why elsewhere in the world people are not recognized? Why are there challenges? Well, that's I think you understand, and I think most Canadians would, you know, a challenge of interesting intellectual and historical proportions, but not specific necessarily to any one area can actually do a comparative study of why nations and states are recognized or not, and how does this recognition manifest itself? Does it have to be through an independent state, or can it find other forms of recognition? And that point, by the way, is interesting for Canadians, because this is the issue that the French Canadians, some parts of the French Canadian political landscape, has argued that the recognition of the French fact and the Québécois can only come through independence. That's the PQ approach. But there are other French Canadians, and the majority of English Canadians say, no, we do recognize the French Canadian fact in Canada. In fact, even one of our official languages is French.
Of course.
It makes more sense, in fact, and they can be better protected by remaining in the Canadian Federation. So, you know, you're going back and forth in both in history and in political realities in answering the various questions. If we come back to the Slovak issue, I mean, was it necessary for Slovakia to separate, or could Slovakia have maintained its identity in Czechoslovakia? Well, we know that the ultimate answer was it was better to separate, and it did.
Yeah, that particular separation, perhaps the most surprising aspect for anyone who hasn't heard of it before, is that there was no sort of public consultation, there was no referendum, not even a straw poll. Whereas today, if such a similar step were taken in any country of the EU, there would be, you know, riots in the streets. So how was such a feat pulled off in 93?
Well, that's a very interesting question. There are many answers that are given. One of them is that, to begin with, political solution for the Slovaks starting already in 1918 was never put to the test in any way, whether it was joining Czechoslovakia in 1918, whether it was the granting of autonomy in 1938, whether it was the separation of 1939, whether it was the re-entry into Czechoslovakia in 1945, whether it was the federalization in 1968, and ultimately the breakup of 1992. There was never in the history of Czechoslovakia any notion that these things ought to be put to a referendum and that the people should be asked what's it that they prefer. So the answer that is then given is, well, you look at the results of the 1992 elections, and there the results are quite clear that the parties that win both in the Czech lands and in Slovakia are parties that have totally opposite approaches to the maintenance of Czechoslovakia. Since these approaches could not be reconciled, the ultimate solution was the fallback solution, which was, all right, let's break up and each go our own way. And by the way, I should add at this point, some 25 years later or more, that the relations between Czechs and Slovaks have never been as good as they are now when these two were together in one state.
That's so.
Yep.
Well,
surprising, I know.
Yeah.
But that happens to be the case. I've been traveling to Slovakia since 1990 annually, and I've been asking various questions and talking to various people. It's really a situation whereby, in the early part, especially, there were a lot of Slovaks who felt that this was the craziest decision to have been taken, and this spelled really the end of Slovakia. That's didn't come to pass. Quite the contrary, the Slovak Republic has forged forward in ways that no one expected and is doing better, relatively speaking, both to its population, GDP, economic capacity, and so forth. Then the Czech Republic, then Poland, then Hungary. Poland might be questioned here. But in any event, with regards to their relations to the Czechs, you know, clearly the Slovaks seem that they can actually do it on their own. They don't need, and this was their argument that was being used in the early years, and even by Czechs who didn't want the Slovaks to go, that they actually needed the Czechs in order to survive. Well, this argument fell through, and the Slovaks kind of feel now, yeah, sure, well, they're our neighbors. We speak a language that is very close. We can understand each other when the need arises. So, why not be very good neighbors? We do share a history of 74 years in one state. So it's not surprising in many respects, given how things turned out. Now, we can take a hypothetical situation where, supposing Slovakia had really fallen on its face and then begged Prague, please take us back, the bickering meaning that, no, that was really clear, you know, in Czechoslovakia prior to 1992, would have not only resumed, but probably become even worse. So it's like you run into these rather quirky and interesting and fascinating outcomes that I think many people did not expect.
It's heartening to hear how much, I guess, how much has changed, how much has improved since 89, but perception seems to still lag quite a bit behind the facts, whereas for somewhere like Poland or Estonia, which has made similar, maybe if not quite as large, jumps, perception of it has remained, you know, true to the facts. So how did this discrepancy sort of happen?
Before I answer the question, I would like you to define or to characterize the perception that you want me to respond to.
I guess so. A place like Estonia or Poland in Western Europe or in Canada or the U.S., it's widely acknowledged that that it's made, you know, massive leaps since the end of communism, whereas a country like Slovakia or maybe to a lesser extent Romania or Bulgaria, the reputation it has in, you know, Britain or in Canada is that it still carries much more baggage than some of their neighbors. Like a tourist who goes to Bratislava would see, you know, even like one neighborhood that's still gray and concrete and might assume that, you know, there's still a long way to go.
Interesting, because I'm afraid I cannot share what you're suggesting, and I'd be very careful with the comparisons as well. I mean, you will find these gray buildings and areas of gray buildings in Poland. I've seen them also in Tallinn and Estonia. That's a vestige of the communist approach to the high-rises that we built here in the 50s and the 60s in Canada, and which themselves are also eyesores if you compare them to what is being built today. When you look at Bratislava and the latest buildings, you see that it is moving forward. And with regards to some of the Southeast European countries, such as Romania, Bulgaria, or any other down there, there the development has been much slower, so that would be even far more evident. The that you would have said what you have said suggests that there is still a perception that Slovakia is perhaps lagging behind, or that Slovakia still has some sort of a shadow over it. I'll concede the point, but not entirely, in a sense that Slovakia hasn't made the news. Slovakia is not a country where, you know, all of a sudden things are, you know, brought forward either on a negative or on a positive side. I mean, it was, I think it was 2005 when Slovakia won the World Hockey Championships. And at that time, I recall, I mean, the Slovakia was seeing, oh, look at this new country, and it wins the World Hockey Championship. That gave it a positive boost. At the Olympic Games, Slovakia is doing actually quite well, and again, that gives it a boost. But apart from that, shall we say, in terms of looking at these countries in Central Europe and Eastern Europe, Slovakia right now, if you were to take economic indicators, if you were to take also indicators of political stability, of transparency, and you know, of honesty, you would discover
it is doing
that
quite well.
You know, ahead of many of the other ones. And it's just that it's a small country, and it takes care of its own affairs, so it moves as best as it can. And I'll add two more writers to this, by the way, to my explanation with regards to the two examples you've chosen. Poland and Estonia. Both Poland and Estonia have been countries which have had a sort of a high profile for a number of historical reasons. Poland, the victim of World War II. Poland, where the Solidarity Movement came about in 1980 and was repressed in 1981. Poland, which had the very first free elections and elected a non-communist government in 1988. If I'm not mistaken. Estonia, on the other hand, part of the Baltic states, which were occupied and incorporated in the USSR by force, and which the Western governments never accepted as a fait accompli and always maintained some sort of recognition of these three countries in the West. So they have a profile for historical reasons which Slovakia does not have, which Czechoslovakia had in part because of Dubček in 1968, but beyond that, Czechoslovakia was, you know, like many other countries in Central and Eastern Europe, just caught up in the whirlwind of world affairs, the tug of war between Germany and the Soviet Union, between fascism and communism. And, you know, basically, in an attempt to exercise a degree of self-determination, you know, to the degree that international conditions allowed. So, you know, again, a Canadian looking at that area will have knowledge dependent on his degree of interest, and if that interest is determined primarily by what the press reports, I'm not surprised that he would be surprised to hear that Slovakia, as I said a moment ago, was you know, doing well and has extremely good relations with the Czech Republic and the Czech nation. That requires, of course, more of a knowledge of the country. And even, as you say, you go to Bratislava, what surprised me about what you call those gray buildings, I remember when I first went there in 1990, and I was appalled by them. I found them not only aesthetically horrible, but their organization, the lack of stores, the lack of any sort of social life around these places, and this was all confirmed by my relatives and by other people whom I met, who simply said, you know, that this is a desolation. I lived in one of them when I taught at a Slovak university in the early 21st century, and I must admit that it was not a very pleasant experience. They have all undergone incredible modification. And recently I was invited to an apartment by some friends in one of these areas. First of all, the buildings are colorful. Each makes a point of having different outside colors. So visually already, you don't have the impression that I had in 1990. You have an impression of a very colorful area. And then the buildings, the areas, the gardens, the new shops and everything else. So, you know, clearly an effort to modernize, to make the life of these people, you know, more civilized than it was under communism, has been undertaken in the last quarter century, and quite successfully so.
As a wide variety of arguments there, I guess I'll concede the point on that one. on a more personal note, I guess, seeing again your list of books and articles in I count four different languages, there might be five, and, you know, awards from the French and Slovak governments, I guess. What keeps you teaching, researching in Canada as opposed to another particular location?
Well, because my father, and I thank him for that, chose Canada to make it the country where I not only am a citizen, but where I feel completely at home. I have the good fortune of being perfectly bilingual. We lived in Quebec from our arrival in 1949 until 1958. I went to French schools, and as you know, I also got my doctoral degree from the University of Paris. So where else could I be as completely at ease as in this country, where I can move from one culture to the other, where I can teach in both languages, which is what York University has supported me here at Glendon College, and where I can also publish in both languages and have each recognized as being valuable contributions to the field and then generally to scholarship. I know people have gone to the States because they think being in the United States affiliated with American University gives them greater visibility. That may be true, that may not be true. I was, and I have been, and I'm very thankful and grateful to be able to say that I was happy to get a chance to have a career in Canada, and a career which enabled me also to acquaint not just Canadians, but anyone in the English-speaking world or in the French-speaking world with the country, my country of origin, and to fill a void, and there was a tremendous void of research and knowledge about that small nation which became a country in 1993 called today Slovakia.
All right, well, thank you very much for your time, Professor.
My pleasure.
Thanks for tuning in. Check out our website, natocouncil.ca, for previous episodes, as well as ongoing coverage of events every single day. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and LinkedIn, all of which can be found from our homepage. Next week, we'll be joined by one of our editors here at the NATO Association for a look at some of the more shady elements in the world of espionage. Talk to a diplomat. signing off.